Well, we're here at MythCon 44 with some students from the MythGuard Institute, and I'm going to go around the table and have everybody introduce each other. And we are in the bar, in case you didn't know. So there is going to be some external noise here. So my name is Laura Burkholz, and I'm the only one here who did not present a paper.
You're a professional audience member.
Somebody needs to be in the audience, and, you know, so that was me. So we're going to start with Chris.
Okay. Hi, I'm Chris Swank, and I gave a paper called Good Plain Food, Diet and Virtue in the Fantasies of Tolkien and Lewis. And basically it examined what good characters eat versus bad characters in Middle-earth and Narnia.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. I didn't know there was a difference.
There is, and you'll have to read my paper
What's one example of, like, a good and a bad?
Locavorism is the key.
Oh, okay. Interesting. You were there,
what?
Huh? You know?
Locavorism, eating
what
local
is,
food rather
locavorism.
Than, rather than imported, imported food. It's very important to both
okay.
authors.
Okay.
Interesting.
Like, what did Sauron eat?
We're not quite sure because he was just an eye. And as someone pointed out the other day, how does he wear the ring if he ever got it? But Saruman is a very good example. He goes to the Shire and takes all the pipeweed and the food and the beer. And exports it all to Isengard, and that shows that he's decadent. And Shift the Ape is the same way in Narnia. He has oranges and bananas imported from Kellerman, and Puzzle the Donkey says, nobody else wants that kind of food. You're the only one.
Oh, interesting.
So yeah. It's very important for them to have local food.
Great. Okay, well, our coffee is here, so...
Thank you. Say hello to the people that we're podcasting to.
Hi.
Do you like
Jennifer.
My lattes?
This is
Jennifer. We're all drinking dirty
chai lattes.
We'll
take 4,000.
All right, so...
My name is Dan Kinney, and I gave a paper entitled The Musical Heart of the Lands of Narnia and Middle-earth. And it was basically taking a look at the cosmogonical stories of both Narnia and Middle-earth and how music is used in both of those stories, and also taking a look at the difference in the way that both those lands were created. So that was what my paper was on.
Okay. Cool. Cosmogonical. I thought she was a professor at Hogwarts.
Yeah, she was. She turns into a cat. Yeah.
That was a very good paper. I sat through that, too, and it was...
It was mediocre, I bet.
He's being too modest.
He's being modest. He saw some things in Narnia and in The Magician's Nephew that most people don't see.
See, one thing to know about Dan is whenever Dan is in a course where he has to write a paper, he gnashes his teeth and beats his breast as we're trying to get the paper written. And then I'm sure it's always a great paper.
Well, I don't know. No more word limits, professors. No more word limits.
So what did you use in an example in your paper? What did you
I looked, obviously, at the creation stories, and both of them use music as an agent of creation or revelation, as in Narnia. But I also related that back to... other creation stories of ancient cultures and of other cultures, taking a look at how worlds are created or revealed, and seeing how music came into play with those. But
is it a pretty common theme?
Actually, I had a really hard time finding ones that use music as an agent of creation, which I was surprised. I thought I'd find more. There's actually a Native American legend that uses music as that. But what I found that... traversed all of them is that there's usually one or two elements present before an actual creation occurs.
Okay.
You know, unlike the Big Bang Theory where everything just happens from nothing. Everything starts out with at least, you know, waters existing and something comes from the waters, or land existing and something coming from the land, or even a deity existing and the deity creates from that. So there's always at least something in existence without it being completely empty. So that's fairly common, but music itself is not that common in creation.
That is surprising.
At least the ones I found. There's probably some out there. So.
Interesting.
All right. Well, the listeners can chime in if they know of any creation stories.
That's right.
Yes, let me know because I could develop it more. So.
That's right. That's right. Okay.
My name's Ryan Joy. I did my paper titled Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Picard's Humanity. And what I did was I used... quotes from Jean-Luc Picard about humanity in Star Trek and sort of applied that to Frankenstein's creature in discussing whether or not the creature, to explore the creature's humanity in a sort of a new and different angle than has been previously done before.
So. Now, this line of thought actually came from you doing the
science fiction part one class,
right? Yeah.
Right. The prompt was essentially boils down to, write a 1,000-word paper discussing the creature's humanity. And I thought, well, I did that in high school, and I did that in undergrad, and I need to figure out a new and more interesting way to explore the topic. So.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's what I did.
What quotes did you use?
I used some quotes from an episode called Pen Pals, which he was talking to Data about friendship and compassion. And then I used another one. He was talking to Worf. And I don't remember the quote off the top of my head right now. But then I spent considerable time on the episode Measure of a Man, where they're trying to determine whether or not Data is sentient and whether or not he should have rights.
Where they actually went to court. Yeah.
Yeah. So Frankenstein was in a courtroom drama, so it was a little bit more difficult to kind of decide, but I think it's clear that he was sentient, the creature.
The creature.
So, yeah, in the end, I sort of basically say that it's really hard to define humanity, but it seems that these two works really speak to each other, and they're what Mary Shelley was doing in the 1800s is still relevant, a relevant question that's still being addressed today, in a 20th century space-oriented television show.
Wow.
So, all right. Very cool.
Interesting.
All right. And Trish.
And Trish. Trish Lambert. I gave, and I don't think I'll get the title right, the cosmogonies of Narnia and Middle-earth. And how, there's something about the respective cosmogonies of and how they affect grief and hope in the environment. It took up three lines on my...
You got it.
There we go. Okay.
That was it.
And this also actually originated as a prompt in the Tolkien Lewis class in the spring of 2012, but that prompt was specifically about how was evil, evil originated in the two worlds. And I kind of went beyond that because, the evil origin and then the grief that comes from that evil and then how does hope arise from that grief. And in comparing the two worlds, I think basically, the most obvious difference is an imminent deity figure as an Aslan who is invocable, who is, tangibly and intangibly present versus Middle Earth where, there are tangible sort of presence at least early on, but as time goes by and by the time we get to the War of the Ring, they're just not. I mean, there's Elbereth is invoked, but there's no expectation that any of the Valar are going to be showing up, and the motivation to go on against all odds, and the odds are enormously bad in so many instances. What causes that? And I actually cited two particular characters that both experienced tremendous loss. One is Elrond over his 6,500-year lifespan in Middle-earth and how much loss he experienced, more so, I think, than any other elf. And then Sam in the moment in Cirith Ungol when he believes Frodo is dead and that he's really literally the only person left from the Fellowship and what should he do. And, it required us really getting down into where the characters are so that we don't stay at the omniscient narrator level and we don't, include our knowledge of what else is going on in Middle Earth at the time. So anyway, so that, I really came down to, I think, the motivation in Middle Earth just seems to be sort of the moral courage, doing the right thing, doing it because you said you would, and, fighting the good fight. Even in the face of hopeless odds, and I understand I made several people cry in my audience, which I suppose is
just a few.
Yeah,
there were a few teary eyes. Yep.
So I guess that's a good thing.
And she's including herself.
Yes, I almost did. And when I read the last quote, I almost did cry.
Did you touch on Eucatastrophe at all?
I didn't. And I also left out. There was a lot. It was like Ryan says, I could do an extended edition. I mean, there was a lot of other things that could be talked about in this topic, and I wanted to kind of keep us focused in on, because truly, and I thought about You Catastrophe, but the thing is the characters don't know about You Catastrophe.
Yeah, that's true.
You know themselves. It's like, I made a ground rule early on where we can't talk about Tolkien and Lewis. You know, it's like we need to talk about the characters themselves.
Right, yeah.
And they don't really know about You Catastrophe, and they don't know to expect the eagles to arrive, you know, so it's like, in that case, you know, it was catastrophic that Frodo actually was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really wanted to focus on was the moments when Sam believed he was dead.
Yeah, before the hope comes.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Well, it's interesting that the most, you could argue Sam is the most lowly of all the characters. You know, he's the most earthy, he was a gardener, the least educated. He is the one who can carry through.
He's sort of naturally buoyant.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Could Sam experience a greater loss than Frodo's death on this mission?
And if you about Denethor, he's the opposite end of the spectrum. He's probably, except for Aragorn, the highest person.
That's right. That's true.
He can't deal with anything.
He loses hope utterly.
He thinks he knows everything. Sam knows he doesn't know.
That's what's so interesting, I think, about, you know, and Ryan asked me, you know, will I develop it further? I'm like, oh yeah, I think I should develop it further, because there's, you know, the whole pride issue that Tolkien brings up over and over again throughout his whole legendarium, and the effect that pride can have. And you know, Sam is opposite. I'm sure Corey will be thrilled to hear that I'm focusing so much on Sam. But this is prior to his even discussion, you know, his inner dialogue about the ring. This decision to go on precedes that, and it even precedes him seeing the star and, you know, mm-hmm. getting hope from the file. I mean, he makes his decision to go on before any of that stuff. And it's like, you know, I got goosebumps talking about it. I just find it really inspirational.
It's a really interesting approach that you take we're all at the 50,000 foot level looking at these characters.
Exactly.
And you went right down to like the 3-inch level, you know.
like Frodo's face.
And that's deep reading right there.
There you go. There you go. Thanks so much. And, you know, the thing is with Narnia, it wasn't as... I couldn't do as close you can't do as close a comparison, because the hopelessness in Narnia, especially like in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is where the greatest loss comes when Aslan is killed, is very short-lived,
right,
which I think for a children's story is probably appropriate. But you don't have that hopelessness. And then once Aslan is resurrected, that hope never really dies.
Yeah.
Even though he doesn't show up over the centuries.
Aslan.
Plus,
there's always the faithful.
The Pevensies aren't really the ones who would, you know, have anything lost from them, because they can always go back.
They can always go back.
So, you know, and that's told from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So
they don't know that they're going to get back to England at this point.
Well, that's true.
That's true.
Stuff. But there's not a lot of internal dialogue in Narnia.
But if you have any Christian background with that story, you know, that illusion, you know what's coming. Like, you know.
Right.
Well,
and
obviously
also,
he's coming back.
I think in the future stories, too, because I know there's some stories where Aslan has not been present for many centuries. And even in the last battle time, I think, you know, he's been gone for a long time. And people are starting to lose faith. So I think, really, if I extended it back out, and if I had invited the authors back in again, you know, to my paper, I think, you know, what Lewis was really going for was the power of faith.
Yes.
And that hope really comes from that faith. Where Tolkien really didn't, you know, surprisingly enough, I think. You know, given his own personal background, he was, you know, we've talked before about how he sort of keeps it out because he makes it clear this is a pre-Christian world. It is still surprising to me that he doesn't bring in, you know, he still is of the
the Nordic tradition that you just follow through.
Exactly.
Even if there's no hope at all, you know, you kind of...
And I have not done this so far, but I will say that this paper has made me want to read John Garth's book about Tolkien and the First War, because I think some of this has come from his experiences, both directly in that war and probably also in World War II with his son.
Yeah.
So stay tuned, because I will probably develop this further. It may show up in other iterations.
Yeah. So again, you now have the Spark Notes edition and the extended edition.
The trilogy.
That's right. Paper.
That's right. Well, we heard some other good talks.
Yes.
Is there any that you guys want to mention or talk about?
Well, Andy's was good.
Oh, yes. Andrew Higgins, who's busy schmoozing with
Hammond and Skull.
Rubbing elbows.
We couldn't pull him away.
Yeah. So.
Rubbing shoulders with greats.
That's right.
Andy did what Andy does very well, which is look at word origins in Tolkien's language, and he just really drills down.
And, you know, I talked to him afterwards, and, you know, he said that what he's really focusing on, and I think this is really good, is the early years. You know, he's looking more in the 19-teens and early 20s.
He really doesn't
go beyond.
Right, very early formation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I told Andy, I said, you know, we all know, because Tolkien said this in letters and whatnot, that, you know, Middle-earth started, or the legendary started as a language. Mm-hmm. But I've never really thought about that. And I think what Andy's paper really opened up for me is it really did start with the language. I mean, Andy through, you know, word roots and how, you know, what words mean and stuff. And I'm thinking, maybe I should actually get into this, you know, language stuff, because you can learn a lot more about...
The most interesting revelation for me was that Tolkien actually took that word from the pre-Celtic language of Britain, mm-hmm. the word ond, yes. which he turned into gond for stone.
Right.
That's the only word, or one of the only two words we still have that we still know of. As if that was a fairy language in reality. And it's kind of built from that. That was really interesting. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And I totally envy Andy, because he has access to the Bodleian Library and all the papers there. So he was sharing with us some of the stuff he was able to see that those of us outside the pale cannot see.
Right. And in bringing that back with, you know, those two words from the ancient language, you know, a lot of times, at least myself, you know, when you're reading Tolkien, you forget that Middle Earth is supposed to be Earth. You know,
right.
So that you bring in real world examples reinforces that idea, where sometimes you read Tolkien and you're like, oh, this is, you know, another world,
right,
but it's
right.
really not.
And especially at that time period too, because I think in the teens and early 20s Tolkien still was very much thinking it was England, and trying to equate place names and things like that. And then I enjoyed Verlin's Flieger's talk on trees, and I can't remember the whole
Do trees behave?
Yeah.
Tree spirits.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that was really interesting for me with that was that she shared with us sort of dead ends that she reached in her research, which, you know, being kind of a newbie presenter, I'm thinking, well, you're not supposed to do that. You know, you're supposed to act like you've got it all together and, you know, all that stuff. But it was edifying. I mean, the fact that, you know, as only Verlin can do, probably, or I got a lot from even the dead ends that she reached.
Oh, yeah.
So she talked about spirits in the trees, and talked about Old Man Willow and Treebeard, and then spent a lot of time on the Whorns.
The Whorns, yes, and the origin of the name Whorn, and, you know...
What exactly are they?
How mysterious they are. Mm-hmm. We don't know how they move. We don't know what they are.
And at some point she's talking about how the name means talking or lip smacking or something, and just, which would be great, except they don't talk. It was just a very funny moment.
I think one of the things that I hadn't really realized that she brings up is when Tolkien has something that he can't explain, he puts the dialogue in Mary talk about it.
Mary. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. The authoritative source of BS, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I thought about that too, because I guess, you know, I thought, you know, it's like I never really questioned, but she brought up the fact that we really don't know much about them, that there's reference to the dark places in the forest, but we never really know, well, are those the Whorns or are they not? Or
right, and are they Ents that have become tree-ish or trees that have become Entish, and we don't really know the answer to that.
Yeah, a lot of
and
speculation.
And I think about it, all the times I've ever read it, I just have always just taken it as, okay, this is, you know, I mean, I've never really questioned it.
It's nice because it's a little bit of mystery.
Right.
I think Tolkien explained a lot of things, but he was wise enough to know that you still need some mystery in there. You need some things that aren't fully explained.
Which is
like the Whorns.
Good and bad, because it's good because that way it keeps you you know, thinking about, you know, what he meant. It keeps your mind activated, whatever. But it also can cause a lot of arguments between people.
And it keeps the whole Tolkien scholarship industry running.
That's true.
Yeah.
Little did he know, right? Yeah. In fact, who was it? Somebody said to me, I don't know if it was Ryan or somebody else, who knew, you know, did he know that years from writing this that there would be, you know, controversies about things?
Oh, I bet he would be appalled.
I don't know. He might be tickled.
He might be tickled.
He was in the English department, so he knew that there was controversy.
That's true.
About previous authors.
And on a weekly basis, he and his fellow Inklings, I'm sure, had many controversies that they argued over. So
I'm sure they did.
The other thing that I found interesting, and I may have known this in the past, I don't remember, but the fact that Treebeard originally was a giant.
Yeah, she
and
said that.
And on the other side.
And on the other side, that's right. Mm-hmm. On Sauron's side. And captured Gandalf and Fangorn for us.
I think that was awesome how she made that, you know, transition. You could see it and hear about it. Like, you can see him go from giant to Ent. And that was a very awesome picture, like the descriptions that she used that she pulled from Tolkien. That was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Doug Anderson brought up this story that nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah, that
by
real,
an author.
Yeah.
Was the author's name?
Well, either Wrigley, Guy Ridley John, or Wrigley. We don't.
Guy Wrigley.
We have to look him up. Yeah, I looked up Ridley and it wasn't there.
What was the name of the story?
The World of Terragor.
The World of Terragor.
So any listeners, if you can find this book, let us
know. They evidently have Ents and they gather in moots. So we are going to have to...
Yes, Douglas Anderson is a walking encyclopedia. I mean, I would like a library. I would like to sit down and just like, you know, do a brain dump with the guy, you know, like we're doing now. Just sit him down and just ask him all this stuff. He's amazing.
More like a card catalog, right?
He is.
Yes, he is.
And he actually gave the keynote address, right? It was a keynote speech. He's one of the honored authors. And in that, again...
And it was on Fairyland.
It was on Fairyland,
amazing,
that's right.
Amazing, something I love.
We had him as a guest lecturer in a class. Mm-hmm. And then I know we've seen... Chris and I have seen him in other conferences. And Deb Sabo, who's another student of Mythgard, said to me this morning, every time you see him talk, he's got a different book list.
No, like he this, increased my reading list.
This book
so
list
much.
Is just like ridiculously long.
Right. If you can find them.
If you can find them, that's right.
Yes. So
that's really the value of coming to these conferences, is having the chance to have these conversations with people that you've read their articles, and now you meet them as people, mm-hmm. and you can ask individual questions. And
yeah,
we've seen
true.
Berlin now at 3 conferences, and I feel like I could have her over for dinner any time. Well, you feel that way with Berlin after 5 minutes.
That's true.
Yeah.
Or Doug, too.
Or Doug,
you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, really cool. Really great people. Yeah, we had some other ones, too. The other one that I really liked was Anna's... I can't remember her last name.
Anna Small?
Anna Small's Painterly. The Painterly...
Yes, that was very good.
Yes, that was good, too.
This was... What was the name? What's the title of it?
Tolkien's Painterly Style, Landscapes in Lord of the Rings.
Amazing.
I didn't think it was going to be what it was, and it was really good.
Yeah, she spoke about how Tolkien... paints the landscape as kind of a moving picture, uses a lot of verbs to describe things, and moves your eye through the picture. Mm-hmm.
Much like you would look at a picture.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
The way your eye
with very few colors, too.
Yes, a very limited color palette, which I thought was interesting.
Like you would have a page of description with green and blue, and that's it.
That's it.
But
that's
all the verbs give you the necessary information,
all the
show and everything else.
And she even used other examples from other writers to sort of show the difference between descriptions.
Yeah, more static descriptions where you're just categorizing or listing things as your description. And also cliches. Tolkien does not use cliches. If he does use a cliche, he'll twist it around.
Right.
Like all that... All
wander
that
or not
gold,
lost. Or,
yeah. All that is gold does not litter. Whereas other authors will... you know, fall into that because you don't realize you're even writing it because it's so much part of
I told Anna
speech.
This morning, I said, well, Corey Olson has gotten me to pay attention to the poetry of Lord of the Rings, and now Anna has made me pay attention, is making me pay attention to the prose landscape. So now I have to go back and reread again
to
pay attention to those.
Did she
read?
Quote anything from The Hobbit in that?
She said
remember.
No. She said they had not done The Hobbit yet.
Okay.
They
now you know.
Yeah.
And in fact, Andy Higgins and I were talking with her, and Andy said he's now... he's kind of awakened in, she said awakened in him the desire to go back and see in the early years where Andy's looking if there's anything like this. So it'll be interesting to see.
It would be an interesting class at Mythgard to do
hint.
Kind of style. The style of the Lord of the Rings, talking about
that's right.
You know, how Tolkien wrote landscapes, how he wrote the different dialects for the different
it's
groups
true.
Of people.
Yeah,
that would be...
But we talked about, was it you and I, Laura, talking about that he didn't really spend as much time describing people as he does the landscapes?
No, he's very sparse in his descriptions of people. You know, I mean, we don't even know what color Legolas's hair is.
Oh, it's obviously white, right?
Peter
Jackson?
Yeah, because it was in the movie.
Because of the movie. Well, and my paper, when I was looking at food, Tolkien talked about specific kinds of food and described meals fairly well in The Hobbit. And by the time he gets to The Lord of the Rings... he leaves it very vague, and everybody has an impression of these large, lavish meals, but if you look at the actual vocabulary that he uses, he says, and there was all the food they could eat.
That's it?
And so in Rivendell, we don't know what they ate. We don't know if there was bread and wine or if there were haunches of beef.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Tolkien leaves it absolutely vague in Lord of the Rings.
Or he'll say something like plain hobbity fare or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And not
left up to yourself.
And left up to yourself. And so he... So everybody walks away with an impression of what they think people ate, but if you really look at what Tolkien wrote, he didn't tell you.
Right.
And you've come to that impression based on circumstantial evidence rather than
Interesting.
Well, that kind of goes back to how he describes colors, too, you know, not really using
it. He leaves it up to your eye, your mind's eye, to fill in colors.
Similar to that,
he uses a lot of adjectives. Like, he'll use, the color palette is limited, but then he uses all these adjectives around each color, and like you say, leaves it up to your, you know, how do you define that adjective? Interesting. I'm trying to think if there was anything else. Was there any other?
There was a really good paper. Unfortunately, it was at the same time as Andy's on philology, and it was also on philology, and that was a shame that they were scheduled at the same time. Eileen Marie Moore was looking actually at French roots of words.
Oh, interesting.
Of Tolkien's invented languages, specifically the Elven languages, and with the idea that he was such a Gallophobe that he wouldn't have used French as one of the languages, as a root language. And she's actually found some few words that absolutely came from French. And they didn't come from Latin, they came from French.
Oh, wow.
And an early name for a cat was something like meowie, you know. So he used some sound things, but that was a very interesting paper, and Andy made a beeline to her right after they were both done. And
oh, that's who's talking.
Papers.
Okay, yeah.
Is that,
That must be who was talking to you.
Yeah, that was very good.
Actually, Carl Hostetter's paper was brilliant.
Really?
It was very good. It was on the breath of, breath and wind as the conveyance of spirit from the gods or whatever. That was great. Yeah, I wish he had copies of it, but... Yeah, he even talked about Old Man Willow in that. You know, Old Man Willow uses air and breath to spread his influence over the forest. I mean, I can't even remember exactly. It's so good.
Interesting.
So.
Another of our classmates, Laura Lee Smith, gave a paper. She's already gone back to New York today, but her title was First Contact, Man in the Landscape of Torments in Perelandra, where she was looking at Lindsay that wrote Voyage to Arcturus. Is it Lindsay? Anyway.
I don't know.
And and C.S. Lewis's Perelandra, and how C.S. Lewis sourced Arcturus but came up, made his story go in a different direction, but she looked at how their landscapes and their first contact with the natives on those landscapes was very similar.
Interesting.
You could see the influence of Arcturus on Perelandra. I'm sure she'll give you a copy.
Yeah, hers.
If you ask. I don't know. You could just ask her.
Hers was the first talk on Friday, and she said, I think she only had like three people.
No, she had six.
Oh, six people.
She had double what she expected.
Because
people
haven't
shown up
yet.
People
haven't gotten here yet, so I know that we were stuck in traffic in Chicago at that time. So
no, but she did say specifically that people who would like a copy of that paper just need to contact her, and she'll share that with you.
There you go. All right, well, they're opening the bubbly, so it's time to celebrate. So we're gonna sign off here from MythCon 44. But
bye.
We'd like to thank Corey Olson for,
of course, for being the source of all this.
For being the inspiration for
none
all
of us would be here or know each other, probably.
That's right.
That's right.
So.
That's right.
And none of you would be listening to this podcast.
What you have brought.
So is that good or bad?
I don't know.
It's good. All right. Well, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.